to order, let's see, this is, it's 3:35, March 2nd? Members present are Senator Stevens, Senator Stedman, Senator Elton, excuse me, Senator Kukash, and Senator Dyson, and myself, Senator Wagoner. Senator Seekins will be joining us in just a few minutes. And the first item on the agenda today will be the Ugruk Unit Royalty Modification and PPT Comparison. And after that, we will start going through the answers the administration has brought us on the questions that were asked on the PPT. So with that, Commissioner Mingy, we'll turn this over to you. And basically, the reason I did request this, we wanted to kind of get a comparison on what a royalty modification program would do versus what the PPT would do to a small remote field such as Ugruk. I'd rather call it Bearded Seal. It's a lot easier for me to pronounce. So with that, I'll turn it over to you, Commissioner Mingy.
Senator Wagner, thank you for the opportunity to address the committee this afternoon. For the record, my name is Michael Mingy. I'm the Commissioner Designate for the Department of Natural Resources. Joining me today is Bill Van Dyke, Director of Oil and Gas Branch. We appreciate the seriousness of the question, and we have worked through the answer, and Bill will spend some time, as much time with you as you wish to address it. But I do think it certainly reflects to me the seriousness with which the committee is taking this issue, and I believe the comparisons you've asked for are absolutely appropriate given the point of deliberations that we're at now. With that, I'll ask Bill to do a quick run-through. We know that you have a long agenda today, so we'll be succinct, but if there are questions along the way, we'll be pleased to answer those, and we are here to spend as much time on this issue, Mr. Chairman, as you choose to spend this afternoon.
Okay, and I figured 15, 20 minutes. Is that fit kind of in your schedule? Okay. Mr. Van Dyke, go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Bill Van Dyke, Acting Director for the Division of Oil and Gas. We've prepared a handout in response to your questions. We have a short PowerPoint slide we'll go through, just a few opening remarks, because I think we need to put these slides in context. I think you'll see that the effect of the PPT credits are really powerful for a project like Ugruk, where you have a new grassroots, capital-intensive project, a lot of money up front being put in the ground. The effect of the credits really are powerful. And that's the capital credits, the transitional credits, and the loss carry-forward provisions. You know, they give Pioneer a positive cash flow in that case, where in today's world, there would be just a negative cash flow. Of course, this assumes Pioneer can sell the credits, and we assume that in our analysis. I'll discuss that if Pioneer earns a credit, it either uses it itself, if it can, or it has the option to sell it where the bill allows credits to be sold. So if it earns $100 in credits, it either uses them as soon as it's legally able to use them, or it sells them to someone else, and Pioneer receives the cash out of that transaction. The buyer uses the credit then. So on the state side of the ledger, you'll see under the PPT that at least we have the opportunity to collect some revenue, where we determined that under the current tax law for Ugruk, we would not collect any production tax revenue because of the ELF effect. At 15,000 or 20,000 barrels a day, small field size, they would not pay a production tax, we determined, under the current law. PPT gives us the opportunity, at least down the road, depending on investment levels, price levels, when and if credits are used, to collect some revenue. You're aware we did grant a royalty reduction out there for Pioneer. The royalty was reduced to 5% until net profit share lease payout. I wasn't going to go into all those details, but under the current determinations, we did grant a royalty reduction for the project down to 5% for a certain period of time, till the net profit share leases pay out. I'll go through four scenarios with you, and they're in the slide packet, and we'll discuss those in a minute. The financial information for the project remains confidential. Pioneer submitted it under a confidentiality request, and we have to honor that. But I'll go through the results. They're incremental results, and I'll explain that in the tables. But you'll see the the powerful effect that the PPT can have on a project like this. I think what I really wanted to discuss was, in all these economic modeling cases, really it's the inputs and the assumptions that make all the difference. Because you change the assumptions, you change the inputs, you're going to change the outputs in the model, you're going to change the results. Just a few words on what we assumed when we did our modeling. You know, the project investment is somewhere in the range of $500 million. Pioneer has released that number, so I can talk about it here. It's $500 million plus or minus in capital investment for this project. For project operating costs, we assume they're going to do facility sharing at Kaparik, so they're going to pay a fee. That'll be a cost for Pioneer. And then Pioneer will have some of its own operating costs that are allowed as deductions. Estimated ultimate recovery, again, these are numbers released by Pioneer, somewhere in the range of 50 to 90 million barrels, and it's going to depend on reservoir performance, and no one knows the exact answer today. Likewise, production rates, 15,000 to 20,000 barrels a day. So that's the size of project we're talking about. It's like what would have been a really good new drill site in the Kaparik River field when it was initially being developed. It's the Pioneer project really is just an offshore drill site. But the problem is, it is offshore, and it's as such, it's a little bit more expensive. We modeled a couple different oil prices, a couple different discount rates. And again, we assume that these credits that Pioneer earns, they can either use them if they have that opportunity, or we assume that they sold them for 100%. And I know that's an assumption we made. I realize the Department of Revenue's made a different assumption. It won't affect our results that much. Our modeler had 100% in there that when credits are sold, they're sold at 100% of face value. We could change that, but it's really not going to affect the results that much. But just so you know, our modeling, we used 100% that the credits could be sold at 100% of face value. And that's, in all likelihood, that probably won't happen. They're going to have to sell them at some discount to get somebody to buy them. In reality, that's going to have to happen. Just sort of a word of caution, when you look at these economic results, you'll get a very different answer if you modeled a well workover program at Kaparik or a new satellite development at Prudhoe Bay. So I guess my word of caution is don't look at these results for this project and assume, well, they're going to apply in the Kaparik River field for Project A or in Prudhoe Bay for Project B. That is just not going to happen. You have to model a specific project. And in this case, we modeled just the Agoric project standalone. I forgot to mention on the assumption page that we did assume that Pioneer had about $45 million in these transitional credits, and because they have been spending money up there, just like the producers have been spending money up there. They've been spending money up there engineering their project, doing field work, and participating in quite a few exploratory wells. So taking our understanding of the transitional credits that could be available, we assume that Pioneer has about $45 million in these transitional credits available to use for this project. Just a word about the net profit share leases. The Agoric project has four net profit share leases in it. They overlay a sweet spot in the field. The development project is going to be in the center of these four net profit share leases. The PPT per se really doesn't affect the net profit share calculations in any ways. We determined that there would not be a production tax today using the ELF. Likewise, we have assumed, and I think it's the correct assumption, that under a PPT, if Pioneer pays any tax under the PPT, that's also not a deduction under the net profit share accounting system. So it's zero today. It would be zero under the PPT for net profit share accounting purposes. So our assumption going in and our modeling shows that for the net profit share leases, the PPT really would have no effect one way or the other for this project. So I know there were some questions on the net profit share leases. A note that we use our own in-house cash flow model, the same model we've been using to evaluate other projects that we used to evaluate the royalty reduction originally. It wasn't Department of Revenue's model. It's a model we have. Our folks modeled the PPT and rolled it into our models. We talked to some Department of Revenue folks on conceptually how we were doing that. They didn't review every cell in the Excel spreadsheet, but they agree with us on a conceptual basis and that we've done this right. We've done the modeling right. I guess I'll just reserve the right to supplement these results as the discussion evolves on the PPT. I mean, our folks have spent a lot of time trying to understand it. I think we have it right, but if we don't, I'll let you know. But I think we're in good shape there. And then just a note on the base case economics for the project. When Pioneer came to us and showed us their economics and we ran our own economics, the project was just way underwater, you know, without royalty relief or without a PPT, if that's where we go. But certainly the base project as it stood a year ago, the economics were way underwater. They're way below what our assumption is for industry norms. And you've had consultants talk to you about what industry norms might be on rate of return. We've hired consultants to advise us. This project was just way underwater. The royalty reduction helped a little bit, not a lot, you'll see that. The PPT will help actually more than a royalty reduction, but it still doesn't, it gets it up into the range of an industry norm. It's not gonna, all of a sudden, this project is not gonna have a 30% rate of return by any means. And I think it's time we can go through the slides, and you'll see kind of what effect on the numbers. So there's a PowerPoint slide, hopefully each of your places. The four cases we'll talk about, just like I said, the base case without royalty modification and with no PPT, that the project a year ago. We can't discuss again the actual specifics on that project, but then we'll show how the royalty modification and the PPT affect the project given relative to the base case. So case two will be the royalty modification is awarded. That's where we are today. So case two is today's world. Case three is sort of a hypothetical case that the chairman requested. Suppose the royalty modification had not been granted and just the PPT was in effect. What would that look like? Case four is probably where we're going to end up in some form or fashion with a royalty modification and a PPT. And as it states at the bottom there of slide two, these are incremental effects or differences effects because we can't show the actual rates of return. So slide three, which is change in the economics from only royalty modification, it should be labeled case one versus case two. Just so you understand how the table works, we modeled three different oil prices. What we call the DOR forecast price, where you settle out at $25 in the long run. All our model runs started with basically today's oil price, and in this case, you would ramp that down to $25 over the next couple years, and then it would stay at $25. Column two is, you know, our DNR mean price, $33 flat, but you get to $33 over a couple years. And then we did a high price case. And just so you understand how these tables work is we'll look across the line that says producer cumulative discounted cash flow at 10%. So this is Pioneer's cash flow discounted at 10%. And this is change to the base case. So with royalty modification at $25 price, Pioneer got $25 million more dollars. That's what this table means. The royalty modification granted Pioneer $25 million more dollars. Under our mean price, it's 21, and the high price is 19. And you can see the rates of return. Again, the royalty reduction itself isn't that powerful of a tool to use on this project because we're limited to so much we can do. The royalty went from 12.5% to 5%. I mean, it sounds like a fairly large change, but as far as effects on rate of return, it's not that large. You can see it moved the rate of return under our mean price case, $33 mean price case. It moved the rate of return up about 1.3%. So for example, if it had been, we'll just pick a number out of the air, if it had been 10% under the base case with royalty modification, now it would be 11.3%, if you assume it was 10% to begin with. So it didn't move it that far, but royalty modification really, we've found that in other projects. The royalty modification itself just can't move the numbers that far. And then the line, the state's revenue, we discounted the state's revenue at 5%, and we discounted, as you see above, Pioneer's revenue at 10%. So the 5% discounted state revenue under our mean price case, the state received $45 million less by granting royalty reduction. But we truly believe that Pioneer would never have gone forward with the project without royalty reduction. I mean, we gave up, in effect, $45 million to get this project online. But my view of it is we got a project online. Otherwise, the economics just weren't there. Pioneer would not have gone forward. If we look at the next table, this is the base case again. So there's no royalty modification. So it's case one versus case three, slide number four. Let's just look at the DNR mean price column. With the PPT, the producer, Pioneer, receives $89 million more than it would have under the base case, under today's laws, compared to today's law. The rate of return went up 6.5% compared to the base case. So the PPT is, it's a more powerful tool than the royalty reduction. You can see from the numbers here. And our revenue, if you discount it at 5%, actually goes down a little bit more, and that's because of the effects of the credits. And then the last table in handout is case one versus case four. And of course, this is the one where you have a combined PPT and royalty modification in effect compared to the base case with neither of those in effect. And as you would expect, it's even in combination, they're a more powerful tool. Pioneer gets more benefit. They get a royalty reduction and the benefits of the PPT. The state would get the benefits of the PPT also in higher oil price cases. But in the lower oil price cases, you would not collect under the PPT either. So you can see that Pioneer's rate of return goes up, again, under a mean price case, about 8.4%. I can't tell you what the absolute number is, but that they're basically sort of there in the industry norm range. If this was their world, $33 royalty reduction and PPT, they'd be sort of right in the middle of the industry norms for rate of return. They would not reap a windfall by any means for this project. This is a really challenged project. It's my belief Pioneer, they want to get their foot in the door. They were willing to come up to Alaska and get, at least start a project that wasn't the greatest project in the world, but it got them on the slope. It got them up there as an operator. And they have bigger and better plans elsewhere on the slope. There's a few more assumptions on the last page. I don't think we need to certainly go through them all right now. Maybe if you just have some questions. There are a lot of details on how the credits are treated. We have some of our commercial folks, I think, online from Anchorage if you have detailed questions. It's a pretty extensive, pretty rigorous modeling effort to layer in the PPT calculations into one of these cash flow models, especially for a specific project and trying to get all the details right. I mean, folks have scrambled now for about a week to make this work. But hopefully these are the types of numbers you were looking for, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Elton.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. And I hope I understand the charge bill. Let's go to case one versus case four, the chart on case one versus case four. I mean, it would help me, and I'm assuming that there could easily be another line at the bottom, which instead of just how much less the state is getting, how much the state is getting. Because I'm assuming that we're getting less, but we're getting something from a field that wouldn't otherwise have been developed. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Senator Elton, that is correct. I mean, you're right. We're getting somewhere between $100 and $200 million less. Maybe the folks in Anchorage have those numbers. I don't have the spreadsheet here with me. But we are, I do have a chart in the back. I know for instance, in the royalty reduction case, which is not what we're looking at here, but under royalty reduction, with royalty reductions in effect, we still collect about $168 million, I think, from the field.
You don't need
that type of a.
Yeah, right. You don't need to. If you don't have the numbers now, you don't need to give them. But I'd be interested because mean, looking at the charts, it looks like it's a net loss for the state, but it's a net loss from what would have otherwise accrued to the state.
That's correct, Senator Elton, because we still collect income tax, we still collect royalty, we still collect property tax.
Thanks, Mr. Chair.
And the net profit share payment also.
There are people online, Anchorage DNR, that will probably answer that question if you want it.
That'd be great. If not, they can provide it to...
Who's online?
To you, Mr. Chair.
Had to get closer to the mic or something.
This is Tim Reihert with the Division of Oil and Gas in Anchorage, and we're struggling coming up with exactly what you're looking for. We've got a bunch of tables in front of us. Through the chair, Will McGinty, speaking, our analysis suggests that state revenues from the first project, standalone revenues from all sources, vary between about $130 million at $25 price sustained over the life, to a little over $500 million, or let me say $225 million cumulative, or a $33 sustained price over the life of the project. And that climbs to a little bit over $500 million at a higher $50 sustained price. So if we see today's price continue for the life of the Urban Project, the state would see revenues a little more than $500 million over the long sources that both growth and capacity.
You're kind of breaking up, but that's a figure for all taxes, all sources of income?
Yes, and that's a base case status quo framing under today's fiscal system. So it's important to point that out. And embedded in that assumption is, for example, the assumption that there would be no production tax proceeds under the existing system based on health.
Okay. All right, thank you. Additional questions?
Mr. Chairman, that was a little hard to hear, but I think is the gist of it was, under the base case, we get somewhere between 130 and 500 million. Then royalty reduction takes off a little bit of that. PPT would actually take off a little bit of that from the effect of the credits up front, but there certainly still is a fair amount of revenue coming into the state.
Yeah. Okay. Any other questions? Thank you, gentlemen, very much for your presentation. It gives us a better idea how the two would work. And with that, we'll go on to the administration and the question and answer period.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman. My name is Robin Wilson. I'm the director of the Tax Division for the Department of Revenue. And I have with me this afternoon Sherry Nienheis, who is our economist, is working on the model based to provide information to some of the questions you've provided to us. You have before you a draft letter, and the purpose in presenting that to you today, and I apologize, it is not complete, it is not final, but I thought it important to give you as much information as quickly as possible. And so what I'd like to do then, after Ms. Nienheis is finished with her presentation, and she's going to present some specific tax and price scenarios. I thought that you might have the most interest in that very quickly, and then I thought we would walk through the letter, and I would go over the information that we have available in the letter, highlight the information that we will be providing, and answer questions as we go along.
Okay.
So that, I'd like to turn it over.
Hi, Mr. Chairman. My name is Sherry Nienheis. I'm a petroleum economist with the Department of Revenue. And we were asked in this list of questions that we received to provide some additional scenarios with different tax rates and different credit rates, and to provide a similar analysis to that which Roger Marks presented on February 23. Basically, what Mr. Marks provided in the way of analysis was the annual revenues to the state under three different oil prices: under a $20 oil price, under a $40 oil price, and under a $60 oil price. And he provided that at the 2020 scenario and under the status quo. And what we're going to present today are three scenarios that we're asked to present. And that would be a tax rate of 25% and a credit rate of 20%, a tax rate of 30% and a credit rate of 20%, and a tax rate of 30% and a credit rate of 15%. And so I will go ahead and go through the slides, and I'll answer questions as you have them. So this is just a summary of what we're going to be providing to you. Okay, here's our first slide, and just to be clear on everything, we did use the same assumptions that Mr. Marks used in his February 23rd presentation. Basically, we're using the same cost and volume assumptions, and we're only using here the low volume scenario. Mr. Marks also did that on February 23, the low volume scenario without the gas line. So we can take the gas line effects out of it and any kind of future possible oil finds, that kind of assumptions out of it. So this uses the same assumptions Mr. Marks used, and the revenues are in today's dollars. That is, they're not inflated. And so just to go through the slides one by one, first we have the low volume scenario, net no gas line for $20 per barrel, and I show you the status quo. It's kind of hard to see, that's the dark blue line, and the pink line is the 2020, and yeah, this is not the greatest resolution, but the yellow line is a 2520, and you can see it just above the 2020 there, somewhere in between the two. Okay, next slide. And then I provide the $40 per barrel scenario. Again, the status quo, which is the lower line, the 2020, which is the pink line, and the yellow line is the 2520. And you'll notice that the scale on the y-axis, the severance tax in millions, is a little different with each slide, so you might want to pay attention to that. Just at the bottom, I give you a little bit of analysis. I say average annual revenues were $565 million more than the status quo. This is under the 2520, and $220 million more than the 2020. Okay, next slide. And here's the same analysis at the $60 per barrel price. Again, the status quo is the lower line. The pink line is the 2020, and the yellow line is the 2520. And in this case, the average annual revenues were $1,300 million more than the status quo for the 2520 and $400 million more than the 2020. These are just averages.
Senator Dyson.
Forgive me, I may have missed this and you already covered it. When you were looking at the, in essence, the investment credits, did your plot in the out years take into account what you would expect of increased production with the varying
With the investment incentive?
Yeah.
No, we didn't. No, we just we followed our fall 2005 revenue forecast. We specifically tried not to model the types of things that could possibly lead to modeling error. But yes, there would hopefully be increased investment if we have this investment credit.
But this does not take that into account. So it's only what we were expecting for production with no change in investments that increase exploration and production.
Through the chair, yes, that's correct. We do have a high-volume scenario. Mr. Marks talked about that at his last presentation. We did not model that for this particular presentation, but we could do that if you'd like that as well.
Yeah. Did you already cover that, by the way, and I missed it?
I said this was a low-volume scenario. And if you're not familiar with all the scenarios, it might have gone unnoticed.
Forgive me for the redundancy.
Sure, no problem. Yes, I believe so. Okay, the next scenario that we modeled was the 30-20. That is a 30% tax rate, a 20% credit rate. Again, you can barely see the yellow. I apologize for that. But you can see that that they're both considerably lower than the current rate. So the PPT 30-20 is actually $55 million less than the status quo, but it's $45 million more than the 2020. This is at very low rates. Okay, next slide. And then we have, again, the 30-20. This is at the $40 rate. And don't forget that the $40 rate does not kick in the transition provision that we talked about, the 6 years, or five years worth of credits taken over 6 years. So just so you know, this is without that, does not have that effect in it. And here we see that average annual revenues are $790 million more than the status quo and $440 million more than 2020. Okay, next slide. And again, the $60 per barrel scenario. We have quite a bit higher revenues under the 30-20 here, $1,730 million more than the status quo and $820 million more than the 2020. Okay, next slide. And then finally, we've modeled the 30-15, that's 30% tax rate, 15% credit rate. Again, at $20, you have a pretty dramatic drop on all of them. But you do see that the 30-15 does exceed the status quo early in the life of the project here. But that, it in fact, goes down fairly steeply and reaches zero at 2020. Okay, next slide. And then at $40, we have a similar situation that we did in the other scenarios. Again, the 30-15 is pretty far above the other two. The 30-15 has average annual revenues of $840 million more than the status quo and $500 million more than the 2020. And the next slide. Okay, and here's the last slide. This is the $60 per barrel under the 30-15. Again, fairly high revenues for the 30-15 scenario, and still fairly high for the 2020 also. The difference between the 2020 and the 30-15 is about $870 million over for average annual revenues. Next slide. And that concludes my presentation.
Thank you. Questions? Senator Stedman?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't want to seem critical, but I have a hard time getting any real information out of this. Is there, I mean, looking at these charts, you'd think that, well, if our goal is to maximize state revenue, which isn't necessarily the entire goal, we just take 99.9% and we'd all go home. But we'd get up the next day and we wouldn't have an economy because everybody would leave. So, how do we take this information and then try to use it to find that balance point between the tax rate and the tax credit, which are the two most critical components that we have to work with the $73 million and the look back, you know, just kind of ignoring them for right now, mm-hmm. to find that balance to get the industry to expand so the pie is bigger.
Through the chair, Senator Stedman, I believe there are a couple other questions that we have yet to model that might address your question. I know we've been asked to find out the effective tax rate under different scenarios. We've been asked to also model the corporate take under different scenarios. So maybe some of those would get to the answer that you're looking for. Unfortunately, we had not enough time to do that at this point. We do plan to do that very soon, though.
Senator Stedman?
If I could, because, I mean, just everybody assimilates information differently, and there's 60 of us in the legislature, so But it's, for me, it's easier if we're looking at percentages versus dollars, because things can get so distorted when we're working with billions and hundreds of millions. And it's cleaner to let the dollars default out and to concentrate on the percentages and the relative changes and the splits between the government and the industry. And when we change from, you know, to 20-25% or to 35%, you know, we're looking at roughly a 2% change to the government take side, and or I guess a 2% reduction from the industry side, be a better way of putting it. I think it's just very easy to get caught up in the dollars, and we lose sight of what we're trying to accomplish. They just default out in a commodity business, is what, and that's what we're dealing with.
Through the chair, yeah, I recognize that. So, point well made. We could probably provide some percentages for you. We do plan to do some of that modeling as well.
Okay.
Other questions? Thank you very much. Okay. We'll go through the written questions.
Okay. So, again, for the record, my name is Robin Wilson. And I would like to sort of walk through these list of questions and answers, and just so everyone is aware of sort of how we came about from with these questions, that both the Senator Wagner and the chairs of House Resources provided to the Department of Revenue a comprehensive list, a letter, a memo that included, I think, about 31 questions, and my understanding was that list was intended to embody all of the questions that were raised during the hearings last week. Since then, we've received a number of additional questions written through the chairs, and we have added those to this list. In addition, I've gotten some questions from taxpayers written that I thought would be helpful information. I have added those to the list. And in each case, I've tried to indicate when we received the questions to give you some idea of maybe the flow. I thought it also useful so that we get them all sort of on one piece of paper. And, you know, as has been observed, many of these questions are pointed to one particular lever, if you will, of the tax plan. And it is difficult to sort of take, for example, the charts that we've prepared here and sort of put them in the big picture, but those charts were prepared in response to a specific question, you know, for a specific presentation. So I think as you get all of the information together, you know, you'll be able to evaluate all of the different aspects of the problem. So if we'd like to get started then, number one's asked for the values for the look back or transitional section per year, and asks also to break that down between exploration, development, and production, and by company. And so the Department of Revenue model uses $1 billion per year as capital costs, and so the total would be about $5 billion. And those costs were confirmed by company. I have the answer here. Indicates there's an Excel chart. It is not attached here because I have looked at the chart and I just want to double check that there is no confidential information on the chart, but we will be providing that information as this information is finalized. What I'd like to share with you is the $1 billion is indeed an average of the last 5 years here. And of that amount each year, it looks like about 10% is exploration and about 90% is development and production. I don't know that we have a breakdown between development and production, but we will give you the information that we do have. Number two, there was interest in the how mobilization, demobilization, platform abandonment costs are treated, whether they're treated as simply deductions as expenses, or whether they're treated as deductions and credit, capital credit. So, in essence, are these expense items or capital items? And so what we've explained here is that mobilization costs, those are cost to set up the wells and so on. Under the federal tax code, they're considered intangible drilling costs and as such are capitalized. And under this bill, for this purpose, we do look to the Internal Revenue treatment. And so that means that because it would be capitalized for federal tax purposes, it would be considered a capital item for PBT purposes, and that means it would be eligible as a deduction and as a credit for capital. So that's how those expenses would be handled. Now, we understand that demobilization and abandonment expenditures are both expensed as incurred, and so this would mean that they would then be a deduction as an expense, but not available for the capital credit. Number three, there was interest in a rating for political stability. I think that this particularly was brought up when there were comparisons between countries. We just had to observe here that we do not have any information on a quantification of political risk. The information may be out there. We do not have access to that information. Number four asks specifically for the loss of revenue incurred by moving the effective date from January 1st, 2006 to July 1st on both the 2020, that is 20% tax rate, 20% credit, and on 2520, that is 25% tax rate, 20% credit. And so we have provided those numbers. The loss of revenue using the 2020 system would be about $480 million in additional tax, and the loss of revenue at 2520 would be about $770 million in additional tax. Question number five asks about Section 9, and Section 9 specifically is about the private royalties. And the question is, what amount is involved in this section? And our response is that a very small amount is applicable to private royalties, probably no more than 1% of total state revenue from oil and gas. And we've identified the areas that we're aware of that it would apply to, some in Alpine and satellites, the NPRA, and Cook Inlet. Number six, someone asked about whether we had considered phasing out the $73 million deduction over a certain period of time, and to my knowledge, that was not part of the consideration.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Stedman.
If I could, if we can go back to question five, this is a clarification. The answer to that question is that, I know historically there hasn't been a whole lot of drilling on the NPRA, but there's, going forward there may be substantial. And is this a looking forward or looking backwards when you're talking about the 1%?
My understanding is looking backwards.
Okay.
I'm sorry, through the chair, looking backwards.
Is that all?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead.
Moving on then to item number seven. The question was of the current 14 producers in Alaska, which would pay a severance tax after employing the $73 million standard deduction. I think that this was probably confirmed in the hearings earlier this week with the producers. But at this point, with the merger of Chevron and Unocal, there's now 13 producers in Alaska. And of these 13, the big three would pay severance tax at most price levels after employing the $73 million standard deduction based on our cost assumptions. At high oil and gas prices and given our cost assumptions, Anadarko and Chevron Unocal will also pay severance tax after deducting the $73 million allowance. And that's given the production volumes, which are reported publicly. And Marathon, and Marathon as well. Item number 8 will be provided. I believe Mr. or Dr. Van Meers will be responding to that.
Okay.
Question number 9, how many private royalty owners are there in Alaska in all areas? And it's a little bit of a difficult question. We do not have information on the specific number of private royalty owners, which would include private oil and gas leases that are not in production at this time. Homesteads staked under certain but not all federal homestead laws include oil and gas rights, and any of the owners of such parcels could enter into such agreements. So we do not have that information. And then item number 10, and if there's any additional clarification to questions, I'd be happy to revise any questions which we may have misunderstood. But item number 10, as we understood it, was to provide a graph showing the status quo, the PPT, and the gas line contract terms. So we believe what this question is asking for is the relationship between the tax under, comparing the status quo, the gas line, any potential gas line contract terms. But at this time, the contract terms are confidential, and so it's difficult to model that. Item number 11, please provide information on the effect of previous incentives, i.e. the costs. And they're referring, I believe, in this to what was previously SB 185, which is currently in statute under 4355025. And those claimed expenses under that statute total $104.8 million, and the associated credits total $33.6 million. There will be a table provided with that information, but it's not attached at this time. And a claim was received by the Department of Revenue just last week, so the totals have been updated from the $95.5 million, which you may have seen in previous information, and to the attendant $29 million figure of claimed credits. So those are updated numbers. Number 12 is asking about the rationale for offering the same amount of credits for non-state lease lands where the state receives no royalty tax benefit. And was there discussion of a reduction in the credit to offset this? And the rationale overall is that incentives have the potential to increase production overall and result in higher severance taxes. Given the overall economic benefit, and particularly gas in the Cook Inlet where significant private lands occur, an incentive for exploration and development even in the event that a field would pay no taxes after incentives does. Item 13 asks about the rationale for incentivizing Point Thompson. We believe the development of Point Thompson may be critical for the development of the gas line, and accordingly, incentivizing Point Thompson may well incentivize the gas line. But I would point out that Point Thompson is particularly problematic for two reasons. First, it is a high-cost field since it is a high-pressure gas condensate reservoir. And second, we do need the gas reserves to underpin the gas pipeline economics. By providing incentives, the goal would be twofold. First, any incentive to encourage Point Thompson improves the economics of the gas pipeline. Second, incentives may encourage early production of the liquids, which requires expensive infrastructure to handle the high-pressure production. Question number 14 asked for better definitions for point of production and oil and gas, and has the state litigated these terms? And so we weren't real clear on the intention of this question, whether it was seeking more information of the definitions that are in the bill, or whether it was requesting us to consider modifying those definitions. So we would welcome any clarification of that question. Regarding past litigation in general, the point of production and definitions of oil and gas have not been major topics of litigation. In contrast, there's been considerable litigation of related concepts, although not necessarily the particular term point of production in the royalty context. In the tax context, there has been at least one dispute decided internally at internal Department of Revenue appeal stage relating to the point of production, but most of the controversy has centered around other aspects of this, including the regulations defining gas processing plant and the use of the term gas processing in the bill is consistent with existing department regulations. Item number 15, there was some interest in making the tax credits refundable rather than transferable, and so the question was what steps must be taken. And we would just observe that it would require a language change to section 12 at 4355024D and E. And we'd be happy to work with drafters if that is the pleasure of the committee. There was a question, item number 16 is a question about the reference to a payment in lieu of and how that ties in. That is on page 13, line 24 of the bill. Section 21 clarifies that payments in lieu of property taxes are deductible. And the only reason that this is specified in here is because we felt that it would, the previous section, i.e. the general rule that lease expenses are deductible, perhaps would raise questions. Property taxes are clearly deductible, but one might say, well, what about taxes paid in lieu or payments paid in lieu of property taxes? So the section of the bill that this is referring to is an explanatory section. It just simply clarifies that payments in lieu of will be treated the same as property taxes themselves. Item number 17, there is a limit in section 12 that has to do with the use of credits that have been sold. And so the question is, does the limit on transferable tax credits in section 12 limit the amount of tax credits that a single taxpayer can take against their own production tax in a single year? And we just wanted to clarify that section 12, that is paren small e, limits the amount of tax that can be reduced through purchased credits. It does not limit the credits that are utilized by a taxpayer that were generated by that taxpayer.
Senator Stevens?
So that the, I thought there was a limit that a taxpayer couldn't take it down to zero to their liabilities. That's not the case? It's only on the purchase credits that they can't take it down to zero on?
Senator Stevens, through the chair, that is correct. The limit is on purchased credits. And I believe, if I could explain, clarify that just a little bit more, if a taxpayer has its own credits and reduces the tax down to some number, then this limit would look at that number that was left, and the limit would be applied at that level.
The limit, so the first credit that the holder uses is their own credits. And then that number is looked at, and it can only use up to 80% of that number then?
Yes. Now, I don't believe that the order of credits is specified in the bill, but that would be how we would expect it to be applied.
Will that be clarified in regulation then?
I expect so. Yeah. I think you can easily get there in the language, but it's not specifically stated, I think, in there.
Thank you.
Let's make it easy to get there in the language. That's what it's all about, I think.
We would be happy to work with the committee and, all right, and the drafters. Question number 18, the state of Alaska has relied on the services and expertise of multiple outside law firms to handle disputes over oil and gas issues. And the question is whether we've conferred with such counsel in drafting or reviewing the legislation, and whether they've evaluated the impacts of the legislation on past agreements, disputes, or future disputes. And yes, we have consulted with legal counsel, but we don't believe that they've been generally not generated in formal written form.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Elton.
On that question, Robin, I mean, I'm maybe trying to look at the language too carefully. I mean, the answer says that they have been discussed, and then it goes on to say they have not generally been generated in formal written form. I guess I'd be interested in the magnitude of how much, when they were discussed, did it result in changes to the bill before us?
Senator Elton, through the chair, we can certainly add clarification.
Okay, to that. That'd be helpful. Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Item number 19, have you asked the Department of Law to review this legislation in light of the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals decision in Cuno versus Daimler Chrysler that is now pending before the U.S. Supreme Court? Cuno is a case that's currently pending, and it has to do with whether or not special tax credits are constitutional. And Department of Law has examined this question. As a Sixth Circuit decision, it does not have direct precedence for the state of Alaska. It is currently before the U.S. Supreme Court, and many analysts believe that it will not be sustained in its current form. Question number 20, please provide information regarding the expenditures that will qualify for the transition credits, including the depreciation method chosen under the federal and state income tax systems. And what we've done here is explain that the type of expenditures, capitalized expenditures, that would qualify for the transition credits are the same type of expenditures that would qualify for the capital credit. And so we've provided the section sites there for your review. And these expenditures include exploration expenses and those expenses that are capitalized for federal tax purposes. Exploration expenses include geological and geophysical exploration. Expenditures capitalized for federal income tax purposes do include intangible drilling costs. And the capitalized expenditures are subject to a variety of useful lives. I believe the draft in front of you references question number 60. Please change that to 59. And when we get to item 59, you'll see that we've provided three or four different examples of useful lives of various equipment.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Stedman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On this question, I kind of peeked ahead, but are we going to see, or do you have the actual dollar amounts that we're dealing with? And I mean, that's kind of what I inferred the question was, and I understand that there's multiple depreciation tables and numerous different asset classes.
Through the chair, Senator Stedman. We have totals. We do not have depreciation schedules for all of that equipment, you know, by specific company doing business up here. I don't know if the companies would be willing to provide that information or not, but we do not have that.
Well, let me rephrase there. Maybe I botched up what I was asking. I think, you know, the point of discussion is there's a curiosity, you know, different companies have different schedules going backwards that we're talking about possibly carrying forward in total dollars. To have that, I think, roughly identified, you know, over the years. So, because there's been some discussion over, you know, should it be 5 years or 4 years or some, or no years or what have you.
Through the chair, perhaps we could just flip over for a moment to item 59. And really, to fully answer your question, you know, it would really be necessary to have complete depreciation schedules for, you know, the companies doing business up here. And We do not receive that information. We usually get very like, for example, for income tax auditing, we get very summarized schedules, and so don't have, for example, the breakdown of all these. That information may be available from the companies.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
If I may.
Senator Dice.
It looks like it's a consistent pattern of the state giving longer depreciation schedules than the feds. Does that work to the advantage of the companies working in Alaska to have a longer depreciation schedule in Alaska?
Through the chair, Senator Dyson, no, it is to the state's benefit because under the federal rules, they can write off an asset quicker. And in fact, usually on a sort of accelerated basis. And there's, you know, various methods allowable, but usually it's going to be an accelerated method. And for state income tax purposes, then it is a longer life, and it's straight line. So it is a more beneficial to the state.
And have we considered reducing the depreciation period in order to encourage more investment in these kinds of equipment that will increase production?
Through the chair, Senator Dyson, no, I don't believe any consideration that I have heard has to do with incentivizing investment by changing depreciation schedules. There has been some consideration or thought. The difference in depreciation lives and depreciation methods for oil and gas companies does provide sort of a real administrative burden both to maintain the records and to audit them. That's a separate topic, but
yeah.
But you asked about consideration of changing. It's a real problem in the audit area, particularly when we get amended returns that are 10 years old, so which we frequently do. So not to get too far afield, but I would say that would be the only thought, and I don't know that it's been on any formal basis.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Stedman?
If I could, just a follow-up, because it's a point that we haven't discussed, and one of the issues that come up when we look at economic stimulations is to go from straight line to some form of accelerated depreciation to encourage a particular industry to do something. So there hasn't been a whole lot of discussion or thought along those lines is one of the levers that we could possibly pull or push dealing with this issue going forward, not back.
Through the chair, Senator Stedman, yes, certainly that is one thing that you certainly have at your disposal. I would just note, though, that for state income tax purposes, we are on a worldwide combined method, which means that all of the income worldwide for a oil and gas group of companies is put together basically as a pie, and we get a piece of it. So when we are addressing depreciation methods, we are addressing not just what will happen with the particular production company doing business in Alaska, but it would also affect depreciation methods for the whole corporate group in every other state and foreign country, potentially. So I would just maybe point that out as something to think about.
Mr. Chairman, I think she's telling us it won't work.
Leave it alone.
Let a sleeping dog lie. I kind of got that opinion. Thank you.
Ready to move on?
Yep.
Item 21 addresses disputes on royalty payers, and I believe that is addressed in item 18 above. Question number 22 and 23 will be forthcoming. And actually, number 22 is, I believe there is some interest in explaining the change in the point of production, and so I believe that we will have actually a little bit more information on that perhaps even a small presentation if, you know, if time permits. Not today, but I do see that as perhaps a point to explain a little bit more.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Elton.
On that, it would also be, when you do provide that information, it would be helpful, I think, to note whether or not that definition should be in statute rather than later regulation.
I'm sorry, could you repeat that? I didn't hear it.
I'd be interested, when you do get that data, I'd be interested in knowing whether the department believes that that definition should be in statute.
Should be in the statute?
Right.
Yeah.
Okay, moving on to question number 24. Question about what standard will be used to determine whether oil or gas is of pipeline quality under the definition of gross value at the point of production. And we would note that the term only appears in the definition of oil. It is not, nor has it been, in the definition of gas. The standard for pipeline quality is not changing under the bill. The standard's based on the number of court cases. Question 25 will be provided. Number 26 revisits abandonment costs. Will abandonment costs be eligible for deductions or credits under the legislation? And so item 2, I believe, addresses the deductibility of abandonment costs. I would note, however, that we are not aware of any field actually having ever been technically abandoned in Alaska, and so we don't have any specific data on costs on that. Item 27, we will be providing an explanation as to whether AS4355160J protects the state from dividing the corporate entities regarding the tax-free standard deduction. Question 28, provide the number of exploration and delineation wells estimated to be drilled over the first 10 years of our economic models. Include the technical and economic success rates projected in the modeling. I would note that we do not include a success rate in our model, but what we have included are 5 explorations per year included in there. We assume $100 million is spent on exploration per year, and with average costs of $20 million per well, that equates out to 5 wells per year. Delineation wells are separate and included under development expenditures. The model assumes that there are 4 finds of large oil accumulations, that is, reserves in place that would be on the order of 500 million barrels. And there are 4 relatively small fields that are characterized as being heavy oil. These fields would pay no production tax under the current system because of the ELF. Question 29 is to be provided. We expect that information to come from Department of Natural Resources, and so we expect that will be forthcoming shortly. Question number 30, if you'll look at attachments A1 and A2, we've included the effective tax rates since 1986 for all Alaskan oil fields on gross value to point of production. And just to note, the effective tax rate shown on these tables is ELF times 12.25 for the first 5 years and ELF times 15% thereafter. So you will see then that the effective tax rate varies from 15% for Prudhoe Bay through 1987, and that's when we had a rounding rule in place that rounded it up to 1, and then down to 0 for a number of fields. The changes that you'll see in FY04 or FY05, that shows the effect of the aggregation decision. And you'll see that note there at the bottom of attachment A1. Moving on then, question number 31, I have put down as being to be provided. I believe DNR provided some of that information in the previous testimony a few minutes ago, but we will be providing a written explanation on that item. Question number 32, it's been reported that the gas line contract will propose the state take the gas production tax share in the form of gas, and how will that work in this bill? In the gas line contract, the state has indeed proposed taking deliveries of gas in place of a production tax. This is not reflected in the PPT bill before you, which will stand on its own, gas line or no gas line. Under the PPT, if the producers sell gas, those revenues would be part of the net profit calculation. Under the gas line, they would not. Instead, the state would receive a percentage of the gas, which it would monetize through marketing. Note that the cost of developing, for example, Point Thompson, or running, for example, Prudhoe Bay, running a field that produces both oil and gas would go into calculating the oil profits for the PPT.
Senator L. Thanks, Mr. Vice Chair. Robin, can I ask that somebody get in touch with me? I have a couple of follow-up questions on this, including, for example, I mean, if in fact we're going to take gas in lieu of cash as a production tax, I mean, I'd like to know how, I mean, whether or not you make an adjustment for the state cost to monetize its gas that it's taking in lieu of cash. And a couple of other follow-up questions. So I don't know who you would want to have get in touch, but if they could, I'd appreciate it.
Certainly.
Go ahead, Robin.
Question number 30. Of the pre-PPT credit provisions that refers to the transition deduction, what is the cost to the state for legacy fields, and what is the cost to the state for frontier regimes? I see here it's noted to refer back to item 20. But I believe that we'll be fleshing that answer out a bit.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Elton.
This was my question, which is why I might have some interest in it. I mean, just roughly, I'm trying to figure out, of the $5 billion that you identified as being the cost of the state on the look back, I'd be interested in knowing how much of that $5 billion is accrued on the legacy fields and how much on the frontier. In the frontier regions.
Through the chair, Senator Elton, I'm not sure if we have that information, but I'd like to just finish our research on that.
Okay. Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Question number 34 asks how many investment tax credits were sold under SB 185, and how do we ensure the person who holds the credit, not the original recipient, gets the credit? Sale of credits under SB 185 do not affect the ability of the seller to claim those credits as transitional investment expenditure, that is, to qualify for the transitional. I believe that the investment credits being sold is addressed under a different question. So I will note that, and if it's not, I'll make sure that that's addressed there. And I believe I saw the information in here. Question 35, if we have a gas pipeline in 2015, what will the ELF tax take be on North Slope gas? And what will the take be under the PPT? What will the take be under PPT if we take in gas in lieu of production tax? And the tax would, or the take would, I assume, be the day-to-day value of the gas less the takes states cut in selling the gas on the marketplace. Without getting into a price-sensitive forecast or the confidential gas contract, we can make the following observations about the comparison. The upstream costs are covered in the PPT, so the difference could be as simple as, under the PPT, a taxpayer would pay 20% of the gross value at the point of production, that is, sales revenue less tariff charged by the gas treatment plant, and the tariff between the North Slope and the point of sale would be paid to the state. That is without taking into account the effect of $73 million standard deduction. Or, under the gas contract, the state will receive some percentage of the gas and then pay the tariff charged by the gas treatment plant and the tariff between the North Slope and the point of sale. The state owns part of the pipeline, then the state will also receive that portion of the tariff, which is profit accruing to the owner. Question number 36 asks whether the current production tax is deductible for corporate income tax purposes, and yes. The answer is yes, it is currently deductible from the corporate income tax, and that would not change under this bill. That is both for state and federal corporate income tax purposes. Question 37, referring to Section 5 of the bill, what oil and gas is exempt from taxation? Just what is discussed in Section 10? And this actually addresses two distinct questions. And so with respect to exempt oil and gas, the oil and gas royalty amounts paid to federal and state governments are tax exempt. And so we've provided a site to explain how that kind of works in the statute. And I believe that is also addressed in another question later on. The second part of the question about Section 10. Section 10 actually addresses the treatment of flared gas, so it is completely different from the first part of the question. Under current law, there are three categories of gas. Gas used in production operations, which is exempt from gas or from tax. Gas produced in excess of that needed for safety purposes, which is taxable. And gas flared beyond the amount authorized for safety, which is taxed and subject to a penalty. Currently, there is no free use of oil to produce more oil in statute. And I want to double check that sentence. The bill exempts from tax any oil or gas used in production operations unless the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission determines that it was waste instead of used to produce saleable hydrocarbons, in which case is taxed. Item 38 asks whether there would be any impact to current state or municipal taxes from the change to Section 6, and there should be no change to current state or municipal taxes, because all we've done in that is it previously tried to mirror federal income tax language about intangible drilling costs, but in fact got the phrase a little wrong, and so what we've done is just tried to true that up with the Internal Revenue Code, so there's no change there in intent. Item 39, why was the payment for taxes and surcharges changed from the 20th day to the last day of the month, and what is the economic impact? Under, this is really just a sort of a cleanup provision. Under the current statute, the payment is due on the 20th. However, the tax is not delinquent until the last day of the month. Now, the impact of that is that it doesn't start until it's delinquent. So really, that period of time from the 20th to the last day of the month was basically meaningless. So what we've done is make it consistent.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Elton.
Rob, so, Robin, the way I understand it then, on the last day of the month, or from the last day of the month, the tax would be delinquent still.
Correct.
Okay. Thanks,
Mr. Chair.
Mr.
That is right. Question 40 asks whether other nations have a 90% safe harbor payment provision, and that too we're doing research on, I believe. We'll be asking Dr. Van Muren that question with his familiarity of other systems. Item 41, what are the penalties for underpayment when the sure-up or true-up is more than 10% of the tax owed? And the way the bill is structured, if the taxpayer does not pay 90%, then interest will be due on the difference between what was paid and 90%. So that if a taxpayer, let's say, paid 80%, they would be paying tax on the difference between 80 and 90%.
How many lawsuits, to your knowledge, has the state been in over the difference in payments and the interest accrued on the penalty?
Mr. Chairman, are you referring to the where we were discussing the change in the due date, or I'm sorry, I don't understand.
Actually, I think the case that I'm familiar with, most familiar with, it was the fact that there was a dispute between their payment of the what was 90% and the fact that then there was large penalties charged due to non-payment, and there was legal action, litigation on it, and it was pretty drawn out. And I just wonder how many of those cases there have been that, to your knowledge, or do you know?
I'm aware of some in the income tax area where there is an estimated tax safe harbor, so to speak, and then sometimes we get in disputes with taxpayers about whether or not they, you know, met the rules. As to whether, I don't know of any that have actually been litigated. To my knowledge, the ones that I'm aware of were, you know, resolved at more the informal appeal level. Is that what you're referring to, the income tax area?
No. Mm-hmm. I'm more referring to the true up. And I guess it wasn't as much the true up as to whether they really paid the full percentage of the 90% and paid it on time, and it kept lagging and lagging and lagging in payment to the state, and the state has a penalty that they assess on that amount, and it accumulates pretty fast. And I know of one case at least that caused some litigation, considerable litigation. I just don't know how many of those cases we have as far as people failing to pay the 90% and then not paying the balance on the true up, or even if they do, there's a penalty incurred.
Mr. Chairman, to my knowledge, under the current law in production tax, there is no safe harbor, there's no 90% rule. The only sort of safe harbor that I'm familiar with is under the income tax rules. I'd be happy to flesh out the answer a little bit.
Yeah, we don't have to dwell on it here.
Afterwards, I could get some more details as to the particular thing that you're thinking about. Would that be helpful?
Yeah.
Question 42, referring to Section 10, why does the AOGC, that's actually the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission, role change from focusing on excess needed for safety reasons to whatever they determine to be waste? Does this provision provide more power to the AOGC on what is included, excluded for taxation? Under current laws applied by Department of Revenue regulation, the categories of flare gas recognized by Department of Revenue are different from, although related to, the categories recognized by the AOGCC. The bill would simplify the categorization and harmonize it completely with AOGCCs. So what we've tried to do here is create one standard administered by AOGCC rather than two standards administered by two different agencies. Question 43. Why does it seem that the credits and incentive are on production along with exploration if our focus is to provide incentives for exploration? And I would just offer that the bill is based on the expectation that investment, and that is both exploration and production, will increase ultimately production, and that investment is a good thing. Chairman, did you have a comment?
I'm not sure. No, it's okay. I just no, it's okay. Okay. It's simple. Go ahead.
Question 44: can the carry forward amount be used for a credit for more than the first year after the loss, and in fact, the credit carryforwards can be used indefinitely. There's no time limit on the credit carryforwards. Question 45, is it the case that any allowable expenses for the exploration, development, or production of gas can be deducted from oil revenue in determining net value? If so, could the expense of a gas line be included in these deductible expenses? And expenses are allowable only if they are upstream costs. A gas line, that is particularly the big gas line that people are thinking about, is a downstream cost. The only ones that are available are as upstream costs, perhaps some gathering lines. That would be it. Just upstream costs that are deductible.
Let me stop you just a minute. We're probably, what, about a half hour away from completing this? Got about eight more pages to go through. I just wanted to ask the committee, over on the other side is a presentation, open caucus again, and it's dealing with, is it TransCanada? We can either sit here and finish this today or wait till tomorrow. If we finish it today, as I just think it gives us a free day tomorrow, we don't have to have a meeting, so I'd defer to the members here what your pleasure is.
Mr. Chair, I always want to please my chair, so whatever you want to do,
I'd like
to
have a free day so my staff can catch up with some of the things that have been going. So, okay, we'll continue until we're done.
Mr. Chairman, I want to quote Senator Elkin on his last comment sometime in the future.
When it's in his interest, he forgot to add.
Okay, question 46. Why not use, GAAP accounting rules versus setting up our own system of defining revenue and expenses? And we would just observe that GAAP, which means generally accepted accounting principles, are useful for determining whether an item qualifies as an expense. But it does not differentiate between expenses incurred specific to a lease versus expenses that are indirect to a lease. We offer an example of that GAAP does not distinguish between wages paid to a lease-based worker versus an employee in the home office. So that's why we're looking to a different set of rules. Item 47, which credits can be applied to multiple years? I wasn't totally clear on this question. What I would offer is that there is no time limit for credit carry forwards under the bill, nor are there any time limits for the optional, what would be the optional credit under the current 025 statute. But I would point out that any dollar of investment can only generate one credit, and that credit can only be used one time. So if there's additional clarification on the question, I'd be happy to expand the answer. 48, can a tax credit be sold in any year or just in the year after it was accrued? Once the credit has been turned into a credit certificate, it can be sold at any time. And we note that a person can apply for a credit certificate at any time, but the bill does allow the Department of Revenue a period of time in which to issue the credit certificate, and I've offered the specific site that gives you the time frames. Item 49 will be forthcoming. Item 50, referring to section 16, what is the current system and why do we need this change in confidentiality? And this bill codifies current practice, which are currently in regulations in our treatment of taxpayer information. The only change here is that the bill makes clear that any person receiving information released under current department practices is subject to the same criminal penalties that apply to a state employee. The current confidentiality law is very general in its exception language. The information must be kept confidential except in connection with official investigations or proceedings. The department believes that current law does not allow disclosure under the circumstances specified in the bill, but there has been some question about that, and it would be desirable to clarify the meaning of the law as the bill does. In addition, there is new provision on penalties referred to above. And basically what's happening there is, to the extent that there's West Coast sales, we can come up with prevailing value. But sometimes what we're supposed to look at is sales in Alaska. And so we amalgamate the information and then, you know, present, this is what we think the value of your sales are. The taxpayer has the right to come back and say, well, where'd you get that information and let me see it? So what we do then is contact the companies from which the information came. It's sanitized as much as possible. But it's a little, you know, it's hard to deal with. And so we have had the regulations in place to deal with the confidentiality aspects. And we believe that it would be helpful to have it in statute. This is in addition to the general confidentiality rules that are in our administrative part of the statute. But this specifically addresses sort of a situation that comes up with respect to production tax. Item 51, in what circumstances would oil and gas taxes go straight into the CBR? And that is, the CBRF is a constitutional budget reserve fund. And the additions to that fund are made for any taxes collected in resolution of a dispute. And so that usually means amounts collected because of an audit assessment or a subsequent settlement. That is not, that is sort of a cleanup provision. It's not specific to the PPT. It's just clean up the statutory language as it is now. It's not clear about that. Item 52, referring to section 18 and 19, why change from shall to is? And that is another cleanup provision made in accordance just with the state style manual. Question 53, why does the bill offer multiple methods to determine gross value and who will choose a methodology? This bill does not directly allow a taxpayer to elect alternative methods. It just allows the department to authorize the use of an alternative method. The election referred to would be an election between using an alternative method or just calculating gross value according to the usual rules, not an election among different alternative methods. In implementing this provision, the department will develop criteria for when a particular alternative method would be appropriate. I don't believe that we can predict right now whether there might be circumstances under which more than one alternative method might be appropriate, and the situation under which the department would authorize a taxpayer to elect among several options.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Elton.
Thanks. Robin, in your response, I mean, I would assume that because it authorizes the department to select from various alternatives, that that could actually end up being something that would be used in negotiation with the taxpayer, and they could say, well, you know, if you do it this way, you know, I mean, does it give you the option of adding new things to any negotiations that you might have with a potential, with a taxpayer or a potential taxpayer? If they say, for example, well, we would like a royalty rate reduction and we would like you to use this method that is on your list of alternative methods.
I don't believe that's the intention of the language. I think the intention of the language is to simplify methods of coming up with prevailing value. I can certainly, you know, add some additional language to our answer specifically about settlement.
Okay. Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Item 54 will be provided. Item 55 asks, under section 21, that is paren small h, which U.S. CPI does the administration plan on using? Consumer price index. I should know that right off the top of my head, but not at this hour of the day.
Never mind. We
would expect that this would be established by regulation, and at this time we've not evaluated the various CPIs available to use. Question 56 asks whether the current oil conservation surcharges are deductible from any other tax. And if not, what is the policy reason to make them a credit in SB 305, and what is the economic impact? And currently, oil conservation surcharges are deductible from corporate income tax, and that would be both federal and state. Question 57 is whether any of our other state taxes have a, quote, standard deduction. And I would offer that we've identified the seafood marketing assessment, that is the ASME tax, does have similar to a standard deduction. The mining license tax, there's a gaming tax that also has, in effect, a standard deduction. And lastly, we would note that the Alaska's estate tax does follow federal rules, and but the most recent exemption for FY05 includes estates valued at under $1.5 million. So that would be the standard, so-called standard deduction in that arena.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Elden.
I would just note, and I don't know about some of the others, I would just note, I think the difference in the ASME tax is that those processors who do more than $50,000 would still pay on the first $50,000, unlike the credit that would be offered in SB 305. I don't know about the other ones.
Yes. Through the chair, that is correct, and that's probably a good clarification for that point.
And license tax works as well.
And Sherry just pointed out that mining license tax works that way as well. Question 58 refers again to NPSLs, that is net profit share leases. It asks how many are in the state and how much they are paying in royalties. Out of 19 NPSLs, 7 are paying royalties, and these 7 include 5 in Milne Point, 2 in Duck Island, and they began paying in 2001. The total of NPSL payments received in calendar year 2005 was $81 million. Total receipts from NPSLs from 2001 through 5 were $254 million. Out of 19 NPSLs, 7, that's basically repeats, I believe. So I'll clean that answer up a little bit. Royalties are paid on net profit share leases according to each individual lease contract. For example, one NPS lease in Duck Island has a 20% royalty rate. Other NPS leases may have the standard royalty rate of 12.5% or another negotiated royalty rate. Royalties and production taxes are due from a net profit share lease as long as there is production, even though there is no net profit share payment from the property. And we do have a table attached as attachment B that gives you more information on the NPSLs, the royalty rates, and the status on those by unit. Question 59, I believe we've already discussed with respect to the depreciable lives of various equipment used on the slope. And that may not be all inclusive, but those were the ones that we're aware of. Question 60, we were offered several assumptions and asked to provide a tax calculation. Gross value of $60 billion, operating expense, that is OPEX here, $15 million, and CAPEX, capital expenditures of $10. So that, as you can see, yields a net taxable income of zero if we assume that there is standard deduction available at that point. I wasn't certain with this question whether it was, for example, 1 month, January, let's say, and they had the available deduction, or whether they used it up, or just what. So for purposes of this calculation, I've assumed that they did at this point have available some standard deduction left. And then I would note on the top of the next page, they do have the capital investment credit available for carry forward and a tax of zero. Question 61, our net profit lease.
Excuse me, Senator Stedman.
Is that the capital carry forward, wouldn't that be 20% of $10 million?
Yes.
And that's not $5 million?
$2 million.
Probably $2 million, right.
Through the chair, Senator Stedman, you know, I really need some good accounting help.
Just getting late is all. Thanks, Mr. Chairman.
I'm not sure what time I did this last night. I take full responsibility for that calculation. Okay, moving on then to question 61. Are net profit lease payments included as a direct cost under 4355-160? And net profit share payments would not be deductible lease expenses because they are in the nature of lease acquisition costs, and those are specifically not deductible. And that is also true in the next question, number 62, which asks about lease bonus payments. Those two are in the nature of lease acquisition costs, which are not deductible. Question 63, power payments for spec 3D handled, are they credit eligible under 4355-024 or only allowed as deductions under 4355-160? We understand spec 3D to be certain seismic exploration costs. Exploration costs are allowed as deductions under section 21, and such costs are also eligible for credits under section 12 by reference to the definition of qualified capital expenditures. 64 asks for an explanation of the taxation or exemption of royalties. And if you'd like, I can read through the actual sites and the language, but in essence, public royalties, that is royalties that are paid to the state and federal government, are tax exempt. They don't even go into the starting gross value number. And you get there just under the current law, and I've sort of walked you through the sections and how they relate together. And so they are not in the starting point. So therefore, when we specify which things are deductible, we have to say royalties are not deductible because state and federal weren't in there to start with, so they cannot be deductible. And private royalty are those portions are taxable. So that's why that's how they work together, the different sections. Question 65, under section 21, it says direct costs include, and there was a question whether that served to restrict the list of allowable expenses or how that worked. And we just wanted to clarify that paren D, which is what this addresses, 160 paren D, simply provides clarification for the general rule which applies in paren C. The paren D is just to clarify those things that might not be clear in C. So it does not restrict it or anything like that. And we also would offer that under state statute, under state statute, the words include or including are used in law. They shall be construed as to be followed by the phrase, but not limited to. And the rest of the questions we received in writing just yesterday, so most of these are pre-provided, although I would note that item 70, I believe, was explained by Ms. Nienhuis information and charts this afternoon. So it's our intention then to flesh out the answers and add additional information as indicated, and if we've got any additional written questions in the meantime, then I will add those to this list. I will put it on letterhead, make it a little bit more formal, and present that information with the attachments to the committee for their consideration.
Senator Stedman.
Mr. Chairman, can we back up to question 24 just for a brief explanation? It ends in the answer. The standard is based on a series of court cases, and I'm just curious if those court cases were settled by the judge or if they were just negotiated settlements between the department and the industry or some combo.
Through the chair, Senator Stedman, it's my understanding they're actual court cases. I can try to get a more specific list or flesh that out a little bit, if you
would. Yeah, if you could.
Additional questions?
I think you did a lot of work here.
We're getting out earlier and earlier. Something kind of scares me. Senator Elton?
Just a comment. I mean, I sometimes can be too critical. I admire your ability to get us this much information that quickly, and I know it's a difficult job, and I appreciate it.
Well, thank you very much. You saved us a day. We get a day off tomorrow. We continue Saturday at 10 o'clock with Jim Eason. A joint meeting between the Senate Finance and the Senate Resources. So, see everybody at 10. That meeting is adjourned.